For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
This morning I'm going to talk about Zen practice in terms of exploring the mystery. This is an ever-deepening practice and an ever-deepening mystery that is at the heart of, well, I could say of Zen, but I could also just say of our life. So in part, this is following up. Some of you were here last Sunday when I spoke of the talk on Zen Karma by Dale Wright at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association meeting. He had a list of 11 strengths and 4 weaknesses and 6 challenges in the karma of Zen that we inherited from Japan. And I want to follow up on 1 or 2 parts of that. And he listed this mystery as one of the weaknesses. I would say it's one of the challenges. So I'm not, maybe I didn't get completely what he was saying about it. That's okay. So just to start, one way to talk about this mystery is in terms of bodhicitta, is the word in Sanskrit. The mind of awakening, literally. This first, and it refers to the first thought of enlightenment, the first thought of awakening. Some impulse that brought you to spiritual practice, that brought you to Zazen. And we have a very good mix of fairly new practitioners and people who've been doing this for quite a while. Either way, what is it that first seeking that brought you to think about doing this funny practice of just sitting upright and paying attention to this body-mind as it is here today, facing the wall, facing the floor. So it is said traditionally in bodhisattva teachings that bodhicitta, that first thought of awakening, in some real way, includes all of awakening in it. Of course, part of the mystery is that this is an endless exploration, that our awareness and activity of awakening can expand and develop and I guess maybe Dale was talking partly about our, as a weakness, the sense of reifying some idea of what that is, as opposed to actually exploring what it is. That there is some vision of what we are seeking. And that seeking itself is crucial. It expresses the vision. But there's a kind of ever-expanding possibility. The Lotus Sutra, as Gene Reeves was saying when he was here, is the Dharma Flowering Sutra. So awakening is not, cannot be diminished to one particular formula or one particular understanding. Awakening is ever awakening. A it requires growth. We need to endlessly clarify or immerse ourselves in, well, you know, he also talked about one of the challenges as developing some worldview, some way to make sense of our life and of our world with all of its cruelty and corruption and wars and so forth, and also its wonders and joys and kindness and singing and dancing. How do we see, how do we make sense, how do we find some way of expressing the wholeness of what the world is from the perspective of awakening? So it's an exploration, and it's not that we, what is it that Eliot says, the end of all our exploration will be to return to where we started and see it for the first time. Maybe a little bit of a paraphrase, but I don't know that there's ever an end to exploration, because when we see it, then there's another cycle of exploring, opening, adjusting the practice to our situation, growing the practice, growing enlightenment itself. So one of the strengths that Dale pointed out is the sense in Buddhism of going beyond. And he's, I think, particularly was talking about the idea of going beyond your teacher. That the succession of ancestors who've kept this alive, who have kept alive this practice and teaching so that we can be keeping it alive here in Chicago this week, were each going beyond their teacher. And that's part of what Zen celebrates and expresses. There's also going beyond our present understanding. So part of this mystery, one of the ways to talk about this mystery is the question of how do we make sense of things? How do we know anything? And also, the starting point for this mystery is just that anything we say misses the mark. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds. Our practice and our life is not meaningless, and yet anything we say to identify or signify what that meaning is isn't quite it. Still, we talk about it. So going beyond also includes going beyond Buddha. Buddha going beyond Buddha that Dogen talks about a lot, that is to say that Buddha, the awakened one, didn't have this experience of enlightenment and then he was finished. He continued to awaken and sit zazen every day the rest of his life. So it happens sometimes that we do have some good understanding. It's possible to understand what this is about on some level. And it's possible to have some experience, whether we recognize the experience or not, or maybe it's this very flashy, you know, unavoidable experience. Again, going beyond. Buddha goes beyond Buddha. Buddha is alive and growing. Awakening is alive and growing. There's a mystery here. And one of the ways to how it is that it's alive and growing is that is this exploring the mystery. It's what we're doing on our cushion. What is it? Why am I here? What's this going on here? Who am I? How is this? So one of the other things, one of the one of the weaknesses Dale talked about, I think, or maybe it was a strength. No, it was a weakness. Is that Zen has this, in Japan anyway, has this tendency towards being anti-intellectual and dismissing rationality. But actually, we have to rethink how we think when we open up to Zazen. So how do we explore rationality? Part of that is to see that there is a limit to what we can know. Fundamentally, at the very heart of things, there's a limit to human rationality and human perception. That doesn't mean that we should ignore them or dismiss them or not explore them as part of the mystery. How do we know what we know? So there's an old saying about not knowing, an old Zen saying goes, not knowing is most intimate. And Nanshuan said it's not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is just some story we make up, and not knowing is indifference, and when we reach the true way beyond doubt, as vast and open as the sky, how will we continue exploring the sky? How do we see what it is we know and how we know it, and to know that it's not all there is to know? So there's a kind of knowing, and another kind of knowing, or many kinds of knowing, that become available to us through Zazen. We can know that our knees ache. We can know things physically. Just the effort to sit upright and sit still and not move and not fidget, it's difficult sometimes. How can we be present and upright and still and settle into the situation of this body and mind, with all its limitations, with all its discomfort? The process of doing this opens up other kinds of knowing. So our practice of Zazen has to do with settling. Settling into just expressing this body and mind as it is. And yet, without dwelling or holding on to anything, without dwelling anywhere. So the sixth ancestor said famously, that not a single thing exists. And yet, how do we settle into that? There's a mystery here. And this isn't about some, you know, nonsensical or irrational, you know, contradiction or, you know, those ways of talking about Zen stories. There's a logic to this. There's a kind of knowing, but also it's about knowing, well, what is unknown? Can we breathe into how we feel the temperature of the room, and also feel that we can't know that completely? Can we sit and sometimes our mind is calm and clear, sometimes it may be very distracted, sometimes you may be very sleepy and groggy? How can you settle into being that mystery? Here now. Anything we say misses the mark. And yet there is this continual, ongoing exploration There's a kind of, you know, we can see this as a kind of empirical, even scientific study or exploration. What is it like? How does it feel? Can we open up to other ways of knowing without, you know, trying to hold on to them or get something from them? And then again, going back to that vision that brought us here in the first place, some caring about the quality of your life or your mental states or the quality of the world or the reality of suffering or some loss or some something that some question, some problem, some maybe some joy, maybe some sense of wonder brought you to practice. And practicing again, is there some searching, some seeking, without trying to hold on to any outcome, without setting up some expectation of what it'll be like if I finally get complete perfect enlightenment? Well, that's just the beginning. How do we not get frustrated by this mystery? How do we find a way to sustain a practice of paying attention? Taking another breath. Of exploring. What is it that brought me here? What is it that I care about? How is it that I can express my love, my heart, here in this world? What is it that's important to me? What is it that I enjoy? What is it that I'm good at? All of those things are part of this exploration of what's going on here. Without trying to hold on to some answer, some resolution, some way of explaining it away so you won't have the mystery anymore. That's not it. It's not something that you'll figure out and then it'll all be clear. And of course, we all have moments of clarity also, and that's wonderful. And we all have moments of distraction. And that can be wonderful too. How do we breathe into and settle into and sustain an exploration of what is it? What is this that thus comes? How shall I take care of my world this week, this lifetime? So as examples of exploring the mystery, I thought I'd share a couple stories or images from our founder in China, Dongshan, who lived in the 800s. For our midday service, we'll chant the Jewel Mara Samadhi that is attributed to him, Precious Mara Samadhi. And there are many stories, and I'm working on a book about his stories, and the more I get into them, the more mysterious they are. But one of them has to do with this image that he used to describe our practice. He said to follow the bird's path. And once the monk came to him and said, well, what is the bird's path? And Dongshan said, it's to not encounter a single person. No, that's a little funny because I've been reading a little bit about birds and migration, and actually birds fly faster and more efficiently in a flock. Somehow, if there's a group of birds, some of you know much more about the natural world than I. But anyway, I read that they actually can fly more effectively in a group, in a V formation, than a single solitary bird. But anyway, Dongshan uses this image of the bird's path for our practice, leaving no trace. And that's also a mystery, because we can't see, we might see birds fly by, but we can't see a trail they leave. You know, some jets we can sometimes see a trail. And yet, the birds follow these migratory paths for many, 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 some of them up to 14,000 miles they migrate. And they follow the same path for centuries. Maybe there's some trace that they leave that we can't sense, just like we can't sense all the smells that dogs sense, or the dogs sense, or the sounds that dogs sense. Dongshan said that bird's path is to not encounter a single person. And I think this has to do with the teaching of no self. There's no single person. We're all in this together, actually. And your idea of who you are, sitting on your cushion now, that's fine. But that's also, you don't know a whole lot about who you are, any of us. And what is the body mind sitting on your cushion here now is a function of so many beings, people we've met in our lifetime, and your great grandmother on your father's side, and so forth. For those of you who believe in genetics, anyway. Don't encounter a single person. And the monk asked Dongshan after that, well, how do we do that? And he said, there's two different versions of the story. One is there's no self underfoot. There isn't. We take a step, and then we take another step. So you might explore this during this mystery, during Kinhin, during walking meditation today. See if there's some self under your foot. Hopefully there's a floor under your foot, and you won't fall through, you know. We kind of believe that, and I think we're taking good enough care of the space that's likely to be the case throughout the day to day, that you won't fall through the floor during Kinhin. In another version of the story, when asked by the monk how do you not encounter a single person, he says, "There's nothing that binds your feet." There's no binder. There's no binder of linen or binder of fear. Anyway, there's nothing that's stopping you from taking another step. So this bird, this image of the bird's path is kind of mysterious, and the whole idea of the path is a mystery. We talk about the Eightfold Path, or the various systems of paths. But anyway, what is it? What is this bird's path that Dongshan, our founder in China, said we should follow? And again, from my very limited reading, scientists speculate birds recognize their traditional migration paths due to things like solar position, maybe, or electromagnetic cues, or heredity, or just being trained by their parents where to fly when it's time to head south for the winter and so forth. Is there some trail or trace visible to birds that we can't see? the part of the image of the birch path reminds me of the Zen, old Zen saying, to leave a place cleaner than when you found it. So we do temple cleaning here to try and take care of the space. And of course, as human beings, unlike bird's path, we're leaving lots of traces of miles of plastic in the Pacific and so on. There's a mystery here. What is it to follow the bird's path? What is it to follow our breathing? Inhale after exhale. So there's another story about the path from Dongshan. One of Dongshan's main disciples was named Ungodoya, we say in Japanese, or Yunju Daoyin. He's the disciple of Dongshan from whom, most of the Soto tradition, including Dogen and Japanese Soto, and we descend. And one time, Yunju returned to the monastery, and Dongshan asked him where he'd been. And Yunshan said, "Oh, I've been walking in the mountains." So sometimes the mountains walk, and sometimes we walk in the mountains. Anyway, Dongshan asked if Yunju had found a mountain to reside on. And Yunju said, "There are no mountains suitable for residing. He's not for him." Dongshan asked, Yunju, have you visited all the mountains in the country? And Yunju said, no, that he hadn't. And then Dongshan commented that Yunju must have found an entry path. And Yunju proclaimed, "No, there's no path." Dongshan said, "If there's no path, then a mountain would stand between us. How could we ever meet?" But Yunju said, "Oh, wait a second! I skipped a couple of lines." Yunju said, "There's no path." Dongshan said, "If there's no path, I wonder how you have come to lay eyes on this old monk. How did you get here if there's no path?" And Yunju replied, "If there were a path, then a mountain would stand between us." Sorry, I got it backwards. Yunju said, "If there was a path, then I couldn't be here. Then I'd be somewhere back on the path." And Dongshan was very happy at this response. "If there was a path, a mountain would stand between us," Yunju said. So, you know, this, the idea of the bird's path or any path is this, another mystery. We are on the path and process of going beyond Buddha, and yet, if we think that there's somewhere else we have to get, if we think the path is a matter of some destination or some outcome or some awakening somewhere else, in the future or someplace else, we can never be here. We can never be ourselves. If there was a path, then there's some separation, some distance in space or time that needs to be traversed to get to some destination. So Yunju disdains any path and affirms, "Oh yeah, here we are. Here he is in communion with Dongshan." So part of this mystery is that there's no need to travel to some meeting place somewhere else. You're not going to meet enlightenment somewhere, some other time. It's right here. Any sequential path of progress implies separation from some goal, thus never being fully present in the current situation. So, there are many people who have great achievements in this room, who've overcome obstacles and reach some accomplishment. I think there's 8 people with advanced degrees in this room. And that's fine. It's not that you should avoid rationality and avoid doing things in the world that express your caring and work and so forth. But in terms of this mystery of what you were seeking and how you were seeking when you first came to practice, it's not somewhere else. Getting lay ordained or priest ordained or even Dharma transmission doesn't mean that you've gotten to, you know, the end of the path or the end of your practice. We're all just beginning, actually. So Suzuki Roshi talked about beginner's mind, which means that right now there is this possibility of appreciating, without getting to the end of it, the rawness and tenderness and freshness of not knowing that is here right now. Now, of course, being here right now doesn't mean that that there's not transformation involved in Zazen in our practice. Of course, there is opening, flowering, expanding, developing, and we need to become familiar with our tendencies and the 3 karmic poisons of grasping and hatred and confusion. So that's part of our exploration too. That's part of the mystery. How do we become intimate enough with ourselves to not be controlled by our own habits of greed and anger? This is also part of the Birch Path. But what is the Birch Path? Bob Dylan ended one of his songs by saying, "My friends from the prison, they say unto me, how good does it feel to be free? And I answer them most mysteriously, are birds free from the chains of the skyway?" So, are birds free from the chains of the sky? Are we free from the chains of practice? Well, we follow these forms and try and sit still, and when the bell rings, to get up and we walk and so forth. So we are willing to take on the form by which we can explore this mystery. Dogen says in Genja Koan, if birds leave the sky, they die at once. So this bird's path is pretty mysterious. How do we follow the bird's path? Dogen also says in Genja Koan, if their need is large, their range is large. So as we open up to our capacity, and as we open up to the suffering of the world, the range of our migration may be large, or it may be small. That's not important. Even a puddle an inch wide fully reflects the round moon. How will we take on the bird's path right here, right now? So this is just one image, one way of exploring how it is that we can express the insight and compassion and caring on your cushion right now. Here today, just doing the next thing in the schedule, and in our life in the world when we get up and go out. So I was going to tell another story about Dongshan, but I think I'll save that for another time. For those of us who are sitting here all day, we'll have a discussion period over tea this afternoon, and we can explore the mystery together more. But I appreciate those of you who've joined us for the talk this morning. So I'll take a few minutes. If anyone has any comments or questions or explorations or responses about exploring the mystery generally or about the bird's path, please feel free. Kathy, hi.
I know this fits, but I don't know exactly how. I've been reading Pema Chodron's, one of her books that I've had out of the library for too long, and she talks about Tongren practice. And it has to do with when we find ourselves angry with someone or really stuck in anger with a particular person, that that's an opportunity to recognize that that's us, not them. And I was, so I'm dealing with that right now. But that makes me think about, you know, birds fly as flock, and they change who's in the lead, and they work as a body, almost.
Yes.
And, you know, I think in this way it's maybe true about humans, too. You know, I work out my stuff with that particular person who makes me angry. You know, it's like all part of the same organism, sort of. So if anybody else has a comment about how that fits, I welcome.
Well, I think that's an important part of the mystery that we need to explore. How do we deal with, how do we respond to others when we're angry, but also how do we recognize that we own our, we're the ones who are angry, it's our anger. And there are practices for responding to that, but yes, it's a mystery. So, other comments about anger or the bird's path or mysteries? Yes, Nathan.
One way that I can actually comment about anger and mystery is just like the anger that we experience is our anger, the mystery is our mystery too. I feel like it's not like there's some mystery out there.
Yes.
You know, the mystery is our own mental process. And for me, there's always been some ambiguity in the word mystery because I also associate it with mystification.
Aha.
Which is like making things more mysterious than they need to be, making things less clear than they could be. So I think yeah, there's an ambiguity in the word mystery. Who is it that's making things mysterious?
Good, yeah, yeah. So this is saying by Jadro about that. And somebody was asking about the mystery. He said, anyone else would have been mystified by this mystery? Or something like that. So yeah, we don't need to try and create mystery. And sometimes things are clear. But still, what is it? Hey, Tom.
Yeah, is sort of mysticism essentially ideas that are thought to be true, but that have just not been proven scientifically?
Well, yeah, there is that side of it, that science does has a method of working with things and coming up with hypotheses and theories and evidence and, you know.
But it transitions from once somebody says they've got you know, whatever the variants of analysis says it should be, it transitions, it could be transitioning from mysticism to something that's no longer deemed as mysticism.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, it's just the perspective that I have the analysis of variance working on some data here at this point in time, but I didn't have it at that point in time. It's the same object, it's true.
Right, and even in our own lives, in our own spiritual work, you know, things that were mysterious to us may become clear. That's possible. We may let go of some obstruction to our seeing. And yet part of what I'm trying to get at today is that, without trying to add mysteries or mystify anybody, that there's some mystery at the heart of things, or near the heart of things, in terms of how we can. So, you know, I don't know. Science holds out the I was going to call it a myth, but whatever. The idea that everything can be figured out if we just get enough data. And, you know, I don't know.
I don't know about everything. It's pretty optimistic.
Yeah. Kevin?
I guess talking about facts and mysticism, I always worry about getting too attached to facts.
Uh-huh.
It might be one's opinion.
Good.
A lot of people say this is the fact, and it's really not a fact, it's an opinion. So,
right.
Sometimes the mysticism is a much more comfortable place to be because you have more latitude in your perspective, I guess.
Yeah, the part that I was talking about knowing that there are things we don't know, very important. Knowing the limitation of what we know or can know. And these are just limits to our human perceptual faculties, and I would say our intellectual faculties too. So to be open, to grow, actually we need to be open to that we don't know it all yet. Well, when I was 18 I knew everything, but then things happened. Yes, Bill.
I think the Greek root of the word mystery is mystos, which refers, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, to silence, and that about which nothing can be said, and so it would be best to remain silent about it. And I think, you know, linking that to other Buddhist and Zen themes, such as the question of causality in karma. There's a lot that we can know about it all, so to speak, which is, still remains kind of a strange way of speaking when we think about it, because what is it all? But then where we run up against something is where, out of the silence, it all somehow seems to be here and swirling around. And I think, too, just a basic question of philosophy that Immanuel Kant addressed very well is that you can't simply go from physics to metaphysics, because there still remains the question of, well, why is it that way? You know, why do fundamental particles work the way they do? We can figure that out by getting to something even more fundamental. But then at the back of that is a silence, underneath that. And so to me, that's the level at which it remains the mystery. And then just one last thing. There's some point, I think, where someone would ask, and I think John Cage is very good about that, that, well, then why disturb it, so to speak? You know, empty pages, why write on them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. We can't know all of it. Turtles all the way down. So, you know, sometimes it's said that Shakyamuni Buddha, his way of teaching was to teach by silence, actually. That our Buddha of our age, teaches by way of silence. And there are branches of modern Zen where they don't, you know, during sessions, they don't give Dharma talks, they don't have Dzogchen or practice interviews, they just sit silently. They don't chant or anything. And, you know, that's, I think that has its value. So most of what we're going to do here today is be silent. On the other hand, there are some Buddhists who teach, it's said in some of the sutras, in other ways than silence. And there's a Buddha who teaches by fragrance. And the various teachings would come to the disciples through fragrances. Now, I don't know that we're equipped in terms of our human perceptual apparatus to do that. Maybe that's a world of dog Buddhas. I don't know. But anyway, there are many ways to get this. And Katagiri Roshi wrote a book, Remaining in Silence, about this silence. But then he also wrote another book that's, you have to say something. So it's my job to sit up here and babble. Yes, yes.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, this remark you made about the, you know, there are other Buddha realms where the Buddhas teach by fragrance or whatever, and, you know, there's our particular realm, the Saha realm. And I was thinking about, you know, this idea of the path of birds, because you can, and throughout there's this sort of unsteady quality to the words, even with this, you know, you referred to Elliot, this thing about the end of our travels, and I was thinking, well, is that a destination, or is that sort of the organizing telos or whatever?
Uh-huh.
And the path of birds, which, you know, you can think about, okay, follow the path of birds, like do, you know, go from point A to point B to point C, or it could refer to following the practice, you know, the path, you know, follow the practice of a bird, which is to be itself, to, you know, Dogen remarks, as you pointed out, that if the bird was to fall, you know, to leave the sky, it would die immediately. But then in a very close passage, he sort of says, well, you know, but the bird can fly to forever and it will never come to the end of its realm. The fish can swim forever.
Yes.
And it will never come to, you know, and its range will be big or small, but whatever it is, there's actually no end to that process. And, just to sort of seal that little lump of thought that your talk provoked. I mean, it seems like, well, actually, I lost it. Never mind. I had it there for a second.
Good. But well, that's a good way to end.
Okay.
So.